Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
9:09 now on this Thursday morning. I've been looking forward to this hour. President Trump the other day was talking about tariffs on films, and he talked about propaganda and brainwashing occurring. You know, the president is wont to wander off occasionally in movies, and that got me to thinking about, well, how easy is it to be manipulated by a film and subliminal things, this, that, the other thing, and why do movies make us feel the way they do? Pardon me. We're lucky enough to get in touch with James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, sir. Tell me about, I don't know, you know, I know you didn't come on to talk about this, but from the psychological standpoint of foreign films, and, you know, I remember seeing a thing years ago about, you know, they just have a frame quickly in a movie of a popcorn or a hot dog or something else to get you by a hot dog. Does any of that go on or not, or is that just all urban myth?
Most of that particular story is an urban myth, but movies are still very good at sort of controlling our emotions and making us understand things.
Let's talk about the evolution, if you will, of movies. I'm a movie buff, but I don't quite know why it is that I like them so much or what it is that I like about them. The basic movie is about storytelling, or beyond that, or are things going on and we don't realize? Take me through that.
Well, they're both of those. So, like you say, first of all, they tell stories. Popular movies usually make it fairly easy for people to understand those stories. They promote an emotional commitment, particularly to particular characters like the protagonist in the film. They also pretty much dictate where we're going to look on the screen. So they're controlling what we're supposed to attend to. And if you go to the movies in a theater rather than watching at home, the big screen really makes you feel like you're in the environment of the movie.
There is a difference, huh, the way the mind perceives it in a theater or at home?
Yeah, as it turns out, there is. When you have a big screen and it fills your visual field, it's going to be stimulating parts of the brain that wouldn't ordinarily be stimulated when you're watching, particularly if you're watching on a cell phone or an iPad or a computer. The bigness really does stimulate all kinds of things in your muscles, preparation to move, and other things as well.
It seems like back in the day they would love to come up with big summertime blockbusters where you would go into the theater and you'd escape the heat and the summertime in reality and go watch Indiana Jones and the Temple of whatever it was.
Sure.
Is the movie business still about that or not, Doc?
Well, there is. The summer blockbuster was... The concept was basically started with Jaws, and I think Jaws was, what, 1975? Late 70s, yeah, right like that. And we can talk about making money because it's the summer blockbuster that used to carry a lot of the studios into profits. It's an interesting fact that some movies make an extraordinary amount of money, but most movies do not. and no one knows why a movie's going to make money. Sure, you put a star in it and you count on a little bit. You can do a remake and it might be as successful as the previous film and so forth. But it's a very tough business to be in.
When it comes to manipulating us psychologically, is that what's going on to get us to like a movie? Is it all about the art? And here's the art. And I guess I'm wondering which comes first, Professor, because if I'm producing a product, I want to know what it is the consumer's going to want.
Sure.
And I understand that they used to test endings on movies and hand out cards back in the 40s, right? I mean,
right.
Way back in the day, they would explain that process, if you will, please, how we tend to think that what we see is a story, but there's a lot of psychological research that goes into what the finished product looks like, correct?
Well, the story should be fairly straightforward and easy to understand. And one way to do that is to have protagonists and antagonists. I'll just call them good guys and bad guys, although there could be females involved. And if you got good guys and bad guys, you got a simple story. And one of the ways to get your emotions associated with the good guys is through close-ups. So if the face of the protagonist appears large on the screen, it promotes a kind of intimacy with that character. And, you know, otherwise, why would this person be so large in my visual field? I mean, you only allow good friends and partners and that kind of thing close enough to you like that. So, you know, pretty soon you're identifying with the protagonist. And the protagonist feels like a friend because you have this large image of the individual. And, you know, basically that's one of the methods that they use.
But as far as testing endings, sometimes they want they don't just have the story. They put it before audiences and test groups and determine which ending is going to be more popular, right?
They do indeed. And I think they still do that. I was only involved in that once. Yes, and that's part because, you know, they don't know what people are going to like by the end. What's interesting is that at the beginning, it's also very important. There are various kinds of rules for the idea that if you haven't grabbed the audience in the first 15 minutes, they're gone. So people used to watch people sitting in the audience and see when they squirm. And if they squirm, that's not good. So you want a non-squirming audience. And so, you know, these are the various tricks and things that people have used. And, you know, the rating system, I've read some books about how that is. It too is kind of a dicey business. I mean, there is I don't know how important it is these days, but word of mouth used to be very important in spreading information about whether people liked a movie or not.
When it comes to art imitating life or life imitating art, I saw a story on Politico about some of the cardinals that are in a conclave actually took to the movie Conclave to see how it worked because they had never been through one before. The people that made the movie Conclave had never been through one, so they don't know what really happened. And I don't understand how. Tell me about art imitating life or life imitating art, and what takes the lead on that, Professor?
I hadn't heard that particular story. That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. I mean, when people are telling stories, they want stories in the movies. They want stories to be believable. So that means that they can't deviate from what you would expect in life too much. And this excludes, obviously, the sci-fi movies and the Marvel movies and things like that, because no one can really fly or do all of this other kind of stuff. But that's, if you will, a kind of suspension of disbelief. But I think it would be very difficult to say. I mean, of course, there have been people who have gone out and done terrible things in part because they've seen them in the movies. I don't think that occurs very often, and I don't think too many people are affected that much. But the arena historical dramas have always been popular in movies, where you essentially make up a story about Lincoln or Marie Antoinette or other historical figures. So that's certainly where the art is. Elaborating on real life, since we don't really know much about Marie Antoinette or Lincoln.
If I'm making a movie for a streaming service or I'm making one to go into a theater, am I using a different approach psychologically to get people to like the film?
It's a good question, and I don't know. There are some movies, of course, that go straight to streaming, and others go to theaters for a couple weeks. There have been movies that specify you have to go, you know, it has to be in the theater. And part of that is to capture the essence of seeing the big screen. Any movie that has got fabulous cinematography of large environments, you know, the Grand Canyon or the Alps or other kinds of places, is going to be much more effective. And, you know, Dr. Zhivago, with all this expansive stuff of the Russian snow and things like that, that's much more effective in the theater. But if it's a murder mystery, or if it's an office drama or something like that, a lot of those are going to happen inside, and so the big screen's not going to matter too much on that.
When it comes to holding our attention, it seems to me like sometimes when I'm watching a television sporting event, you know, for the love of God, or an award show, whatever it is, I don't watch a lot of award shows, but could you maybe stay on the shot for more than a second and a half so I can see what the hell it is I'm trying to see? Because they change a shot every second and a half. How has that changed in movies, or have you studied that at all?
No, I've studied that a lot, and you don't have enough time for me to go through all
this. I want
to
hear it, because the whole thing fascinates me about, you know, life so, imitating art and what's driving here.
Right. So from the 1930s to through the 1950s, the average shot length in movies was about 10 seconds. And then it began to gradually decline through about 2010 to about an average of 3.5 seconds. And I haven't seen any data which shows that it's gotten faster, but in part, there's been a fairly recent fascination with long takes. Often at the beginning of movies, there'll be a shot that's digitally knit together that might be 2 minutes long or 10 minutes long or whatever, just to sort of get the audience into it. So average shot duration is probably 3.5, but of course, it climaxes, in an Mission Impossible film or something like that. 1.5 seconds is about that. Most of that is to play on your emotions. It's not necessarily promoting your understanding of what's going on. So let me just give you a contrast between classic Hong Kong action films and classic Hollywood action films. Hollywood action films do make that cut like every, you know, second or second and a half. Hong Kong action films don't. They show a long shot of the protagonist doing something like a triple flip in the air, dragging their foot across the neck of the antagonist, and it's all done in one shot. And the reason for that is that Hong Kong films classically were interested in the artistry, the ability of the actor to do these wonderfully complicated things. And Hollywood films aren't interested in that. They just want you to be excited. I don't know what's happened to Hong Kong films now that they're sort of integrated into Chinese films and, you know, what's happened there. But it depends on the goals there. So when somebody is changing the shot duration every second and a half, they're not interested in having you understand anything. They just want you to be excited.
Is that a function of the director or of the editor when they put all this together?
Yeah, and the producer, too. I mean, the producer has ideas of what should happen. Mm-hmm. The director shapes those ideas, usually in conjunction with a producer. And the editor may have enough independence so that they can try out a bunch of different things. And the editor is certainly going to show various versions of a particular scene or group of scenes to the director. And I actually think that the editors do have a lot of control over over what they're doing. But one thing about the control of gaze, which I talked about earlier, is that movie makers know
the
where you're
looking. Control of what, Professor?
Sorry?
What'd you say, the control of what?
They control your gaze.
Oh, gaze, G-A-Z-E.
Where you're looking. Right.
Yeah, okay.
Where you're looking, yeah. Right. So they know where you're looking, and then in the next shot, they put up where you want to look in the next shot. So they superimpose where you ought to be looking on the screen, and that helps you to see the objects that are consecutively available in the movie, and to help you sort of understand at least a little bit of what's going on.
So what we're talking about is we are being intensely manipulated when we watch a movie and we don't realize it. Would that be accurate?
I don't know. Intensely, we're certainly being manipulated. We usually go in fully aware of what we want to see, and we want to experience a good story, right? Mm-hmm. And telling a good story is a very difficult thing. I mean, basically, a movie that makes money is usually a good story. But people don't really know how to tell what a good story is, whether it'll make money or not. So, you know, they're trying all kinds of things to make the story more interesting. And so they beef up trying to control where you're looking. They beef up what they think is the emotional content. I mean, the emotional content is often dictated by the music in the background, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they'll put on triumphal music when things are going well. They'll put on creepy music when things are kind of horrific. That's one of the ways in which they control your emotions.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I was cooking something the other day, and a movie was on the television. I don't know what movie it was, but I couldn't see it. And as I was chopping the food, I told the dog, uh-oh, something scary is about to happen.
Right.
And that's exactly what it was. All right, we'll pick it up right here when we come back. 9:25. We're having an interesting conversation about our minds and movies with James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage, Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. He's done a lot of studies on this. We'll talk about nonlinear storytelling when we come back, and is there one way that's better than the other? And when it comes to the way movies have changed, the rhythms that they use in movies, and I guess that would be a combination both of the director and the editor and the producer, mirroring the human body. And I'll tell you about something I found out about jazz and a Geiger counter that blew my mind when I first heard about it. Back in a flash, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:31, 29 till 10. We started off with President Trump last week talking about movies and propaganda, and they got me to thinking about how movies influence your mind, and we found James Cutting, a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University, author of Movies on Our Minds, The Evolution of Cinematic Engagement. And Professor, what led you as a psychologist to take on this mission or this work, if you will, with movies?
Yeah, good story. I've always been interested in perception, and I've always particularly been interested in visual perception. I've been interested in pictures, and it pretty much was movies was the kind of next thing that I might be interested in. But directly, I used to watch a lot of movies with my daughters, and anyone who's watched movies with children knows that you like to watch the same movie over and over and over again. And, it's kind of fun to do that. But once you've seen a movie, and the particular movie I'm thinking about is Sound of Music, 1965, and I watched that movie many times with my daughters. And after watching it about 9 or 10 times, I began to be interested in how the movie was made, how it was put together. And that really led into a study of movies that I did for over 15 years.
In terms of why your daughters were so engaged in the movie, Or would you see it over and over again?
No, that's certainly part of it. And some of the things we've already talked about with respect to, you know, close-ups and music and identifying and things like that. No, I mean, in other words, I'd already known the story. And, I began to be interested in how the editors put together various scenes. And I began to notice that there were some inconsistencies across shots within the scene. And that implicated that some of the shots were taken in one take on one day and another take on another day. And then that led to just the investigation of, you know, what's going on here? What are the parameters that make an editor and director put all these things together?
So what goes on in our minds when we're watching a movie? Maybe it's a slasher movie or a horror movie. And let's talk about The Omen, for example, right, where that Rottweiler, whatever it is, where the woman shows up with a knife. I forgot exactly because it's been a while since I've seen the movie. But we know in our minds that there were sound technicians all over the place. There were set decorators. There were a bunch of people standing around smoking cigarettes, whatever, watching this being filmed, right?
Right.
But yet, yes, somehow in our mind, we allow ourselves to be terrified. What goes on in our mind for that to happen?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things, one of the interesting ideas in philosophy and psychology is the emotions that we feel when we watch movies. So when we watch a horror film, we're scared, but there's a sense in which we know we're completely safe. Mm-hmm. Whereas if the same thing were happening in real life, we'd just be, the bejesus would be scared mm-hmm. out of us. And so it's as if we have these practice emotions that we can use in watching a popular film, and those practice emotions give us some ability to extend our experience. In other words, we like being scared as long as we're safe, and we like being in love even though we're just sitting in a chair. And, you know, all those things are emotions. Those are genuine emotions, but they don't have anything. They're experiential emotions that happen in watching and listening to a particular story, and we feel them, but they're not ones that are connected to everyday life.
I'm going to ask you a question here, and then Tim's going to give you my insurance information so you can bill my insurance company, okay, doctor? And here's the question. Before Katrina, and you all know what happened. You know what happened with Katrina,
sure,
here, right? Before Katrina,
sure,
and writing it out here at the radio station, all that stuff, I hated horror movies. I couldn't stand them. After Katrina, I have no earthly idea. I couldn't get enough of them. What went on in my mind? Do you have any idea there what happened?
I don't, but it's interesting that perhaps the horror movie lets you experience or re-experience some of the emotions that you were genuinely going on during Katrina, but you were in a safe place. So you got to experience the range of emotions or some of the range of emotions, but knowing that, you know, this is not a real thing. This is not like, you know, floods coming in hospitals and people stranded on roofs and things like that. So, yeah, there's a whole, you know, I don't think anyone really understands why horror films are so effective, but they certainly are. And I think it's the idea of being able to experience these extreme emotions in a safe place.
So you talk about rhythms in movies that are not unlike those of the human body. And I mentioned that I learned the other day, and I didn't realize that such a thing existed, plutonium jazz, a short-lived, unique jazz genre that gained popularity in the 40s, where bass players would synchronize their beats with the clicks of a Geiger counter, but they had to stop doing it because people were getting radiation poisoning.
Well, I don't know about that.
No, I'm telling you, that's a fact. That's at least that's what my research shows me. But when it comes to filmmakers and rhythms of the body, how do they tell me about that?
Well, I think it's all done intuitively. I've actually worked with a filmmaker on looking at various drafts of the film and then looking at the final film. And there are simultaneous rhythms that go on. I mean, these would be represented in a Geiger counter, the clicks there too. But let's think of it this way. There are three things that we pretty much all do. We breathe, and we tend to breathe 10 times a minute or so. Our heart beats, and you know that depends on what we're doing, but it might be from 50 to 80 times a minute. And most all of us can walk, and we can walk at various kinds of speeds. Now, if we're walking, our heart is beating, and we're also breathing. But what's interesting is that those three patterns are not synchronized. So in other words, when you're taking your breath, it's not the case that your heart is beating at a particular time or that you're taking a particular step. Those go on simultaneously, and that's life. That's perfectly natural. And so what I think filmmakers do when they make film is the people who are filmmakers and write about film say that they're interested in a particular rhythm that a scene will have or a bunch of scenes together. And, you know, there's a whole lot of mathematical analysis that I've gone into there, but it's not it's not executable very fast. But the whole idea is that what filmmakers are doing, particularly editors, is that they are creating simultaneous rhythms in a film that are not unlike the rhythms of breathing, heartbeats, and walking.
So let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about movies are definitely manipulating us one way or the other. And is there any watchdog, any way of making sure that we're not being manipulated in one way or the other to our detriment? And I know there are movies that, you know, they're so-called documentaries that are designed to elicit a response from you one way or the other or lead you in one direction or the other. We're talking to James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University, about why do movies make us feel the way they do and what's going on in our brain. If you have any questions or comments, you can text them in to 504-260-1870. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. 9:46, 14 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Having an interesting hour here with Dr. James Cutting. He is a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. And he wrote the book I got in front of me here, Movies on Our Minds, and it goes to how our movies draw us in and what do they do to us psychologically. So, Professor, when it comes to so-called documentaries, and I don't know how you can find, you know, again, this goes to, and this job has really driven me crazy because I don't know what absolute truth is. I don't know how you find absolute truth because there are so many different gradients, and to tell the entire story would behind anything would be volumes and volumes if you're going to give every offshoot and this and that and the other thing. So it's generalizations a lot of times. But when it comes to documentaries, are there some ways that people can notice whether or not they're intentionally being manipulated or some warning signs?
Probably only if they know in advance a little bit about the area that is being covered in the documentary. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about documentaries is that they, over the last 25 years, have been the fastest growing genre of film. It's not exactly the case that you can call them popular films, but mm-hmm. they are certainly produced. I think one of the things that makes a documentary so easy to make is that it's generally cheap. You don't need CGI. You don't need color toning. You don't need a lot of the other things that go on. You can use a voiceover narration over the shots, and the voiceover can say anything that you want. In other words, they're relatively easy to make. You don't have a whole lot of rapid shots that are only, you know, a second and a half long, like we were talking about earlier. So they're cheap, and of course, people make them for particular reasons. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to tell whether what is truth. You're exactly right, but I don't know how to tell from a documentary whether it's telling the truth or not, because you usually don't get a chance to check. I mean, just like any bit of news, I like to check from at least two sources to see if what I'm hearing is something I should believe in or not, if it's important enough for me to find out.
Are you concerned with any kind of, as a psychologist, any kind of manipulation going on with films that, because again, they're designed to manipulate us because they want us to want to watch the movie, right? And want to pay to see it or whatever. So are you, is there any safeguard against some kind of negative manipulation? Are you concerned at all as a psychologist that that's going on, that all of us are being somehow brainwashed into doing this or that or the other thing?
Well, I guess what worries me most about sort of contemporary filmmaking is the fact that you can have AI-generated characters that look exactly like the real ones. Mm-hmm. So you can make, if you will, fake histories with people, it looks like, politicians or anybody else that you think you know about, and it will appear to be the truth when in fact it's just a figment of somebody's computer engineering. Yeah, that scares me a lot.
When it comes to engagement of people, and somebody texting about losing a child and watching movies, whether or not their spouse should watch a movie or not, how do you come up as a psychologist and a man who studied film? What would you advise people as to, maybe if you're going through this, you shouldn't watch that. Maybe if you're not going through this, you should watch. You understand what I'm asking you?
Yeah, I do understand what you're asking. And I think, if you're going through a tough patch, I think you have to find out a little bit about more information about what it is that you might be going to watch and then just decide whether to do it or not. I mean, I sort of had an experience with this a little while ago when the movie 12 Years a Slave came out. Mm-hmm. And, it's very much against, if you will, white civilization in America at a particular time. And I had to prepare myself for that. And the film was incredibly powerful, and I'm very glad I saw it, but it took me a while to get myself in a place that I could watch that and appreciate it. So I think that kind of thing happens in a lot of different circumstances. I mean, some people, you walk into a situation and say, do I really want to see an action film right now, or would I rather see a bromance or something like that? And so, yeah, okay, you make a decision. I think some of that decision is based on how you feel at a given moment, and then some of that decision is based on what you've been through and any, particular agony that you had about a particular topic. So, yeah, I would say, find out more about what it is that you might watch and ask people who have seen it. And, is it going to be right for me? And sometimes it will be and sometimes not.
I can't thank you enough time for your professor. Films fascinate me. The human mind fascinates me. And you fascinate me because you put them all together. James E. Cutting, the book is Movies on Our Minds. He's a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. And when it comes to truth, I don't know what absolute truth there is or what it looks like. 9:53, back in a flash, WWL.